Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Happy Valentine's Day, friends. Obviously, many of us are thinking about love today, or the day this airs. Maybe you're listening to it on another day, but you're still probably thinking about love. Whether you want to or not, the messaging on Valentine's Day is to see love, to connect with love, or to buy love. Or if you want to take part in Valentine's Day by not taking part, by having the antitheses of it with Galentine's Day, or buying things that relate to how single you are, posting things that relate to how much you hate Valentine's Day, etc., etc. It's all around. I wanted to talk about love, but I wanted to talk about it in a different way. Love is the great presence in our lives. Love for our partners, for ourselves, for God, for things, for events, for where we live. So it's a constant companion. But the other constant companion is death. Love and death walk hand in hand together. But how exactly do they walk hand in hand? How do they relate to each other? So I asked my friend and frequent guest of the show, Caitlin Doty, to talk about all of this with me. We walk together with love and death, working to define each on our own terms.
It's the thing that makes death hard, and thus it's the thing that makes death beautiful, and thus it's the thing that makes the cycle of life and death beautiful.
When we talk about love, a lot of times we're talking about, I know that you're not me, which is not something that we ever have proof for. I can't ever prove that you're not just part of me, but that I say that you aren't part of me indicates that I love you. To frame this conversation a little bit more, I want to tell you where I'm coming from when it comes to love and death. For me, I go into this a bit on the show, but for me, love is an emanating presence. The laws of form and nature and who we are, they all radiate from love. So love is therefore an inexhaustible, living givingness. To enter into givingness is to enter into love. The spiritual teacher Peter Dunav put it this way. Everyone speaks about love. How do you know that a person has love? Where there is love, there is always giving. It is impossible for a person to have love and not to give. When love leaves a person, they stop giving. Love expands people and arouses in them the desire to give. This law can be tested everywhere in life. Give as long as you have love within you. Giving is an inner process which unites people with God. In that unity, there is a kind of healing. There's a remaking of wholeness. So I think that when we give with love, we become healed. Of course, when we receive love, it can be healing as well. But when we give with it, there's a healingness because there's a unity. Here, I'll read a little poem by Paul Perry, the great Irish poet. I actually have a poem of his right in the beginning of my novel, Hawk Mountain. This is a different poem. That one's quite dark. I include this one here because I read this poem shortly after I moved to Ireland. I felt that I could be made anew by love because love is healing. It's a trust. It's a wisdom. And this poem is called Promise. You get off the train in another nowhere town, and are welcomed home. The wind leads you to a road, and you start to walk. Where you came from is nowhere like this. A man is pushing a bike. He tells you the rain is on its way, but you don't see. He offers you a place to sleep. You keep going to where there are fields. Not far from a river, someone is calling out. A woman is standing in the doorway of a house. She sees through you. In her silence, there is something of a promise, something which suggests you could, if you wanted, become again the person you wished to be. You can hear the voices of children, their laughter. You can choose to walk on. You've been traveling a long time. Before you speak the first words of the day, you can rest. The world is waking, and the morning is welling onto your lips. Speak. Say something. You can still be healed. That sort of trust that comes with love, even when you're in a new and strange place, a place that could make you feel lonely, or a place that could make you feel like you didn't know what you were doing with your life, that there was a wound or a lack. You can see that in that place, love is there, it's present, it's giving to you, and not only giving, it's giving you a chance to be healed, to become new. I love that. When we enter into love, it changes our encounter with everything, including death. Here's another poem, this time by Rumi. If you want to get into love and death, Rumi probably does a better job than most. But here you are. This is called Fear of Yourself. Everyone's death is of the same quality as himself. To the enemy of God, an enemy. To the friend of God, a friend. Your fear of death and fleeing from it is really your fear of yourself. Pay attention, dear soul. For me, love carries us through death and into new life through reincarnation. And the life between death and new birth, there's a life between there as well. For Caitlin, as you'll hear on the episode, she's concerned so thoughtfully with the corpse and how the body, that is, the material body, enters into that givingness. In other words, the way the corpse offers love. I'm going to play a clip here, maybe surprisingly to some of you, from a horror series called Midnight Mass, which is by Mike Flanagan. It is a beautiful series. It's overly ambitious. It's a mess. In some places, it's even a catastrophe. And yet, I have such love for that attempt. It is really someone trying to put out something really unsettlingly beautiful, loving and horrifying, and to encompass so much about God and death and love in this horror series. So two of the main characters have little monologues about love and death, and basically what happens when you die. I'm saving one of them for you when you watch the series, but something I love about the exchange is it's not unlike the exchange that Caitlin and I have had on this episode, but I'm going to play the one that really identifies, I think, well with the things that Caitlin says, because it's expressed very beautifully, and Caitlin expresses it beautifully on the show too, but this is a work of fiction, and so it gives a lot more space to this monologue and expressing it poetically in a way that conversation sometimes allows, but often in conversation we want to move deeper or go into a point with each other, whereas this monologue just gets to go on and on. So here it is.
I can speak for myself, I guess.
Then speak for yourself. What happens when you die?
When I die, my body stops functioning. Shut down. All at once or gradually, my breathing stops, my heart stops beating. Clinical death. And a bit later, like 5 whole minutes later, my brain cells start dying. But in the meantime, in between, maybe my brain releases a flood of DMT. It's a psychedelic drug released when we dream, so I dream. I dream bigger than I have ever dreamed before, because it's all of it, just the last dump of DMT all at once, and my neurons are firing, and I'm seeing this firework display of memories and imagination, and I am just tripping. I'm really tripping balls, because my mind's rifling through the memories, you know, long and short term, and the dreams mixed with the memories, and it's a curtain call. Dream to end all dreams. One last great dream as my mind empties the fucking missile silos, and then brain activity ceases and there is nothing left of me. Pain. No memory, no awareness that I ever was, no. That I ever hurt someone. That I ever killed someone. Everything is as it was before me. And the electricity disperses from my brain till it's just dead tissue. Me. Oblivion. And all the other little things that make me up, they... microbes and bacterium and the billion other little things that live on my eyelashes and my hair and my mouth and on my skin and in my gut and everywhere else, they just keep on living and eating. And I'm serving a purpose. I'm feeding life. And I'm broken apart and all the littlest pieces of me are just recycled and I'm billions of other places and my atoms are in plants, bugs, the animals, and I am like the stars that are in the sky. There one moment and then just scattered across the goddamn cosmos.
See, even when we die, we are giving. We enter into incarnation as love and we leave it as love, and that includes our material bodies. Rudolf Steiner said that love is a giving capacity. The more you give, the more you have to give. He also said, love is the only passion which must not be discarded in the pursuit of truth. It underlies everything, and death is no exception. I'm so happy to share this episode with you. If you love this podcast, let's keep it growing together. Go to patreon.com/ConorHabib and pledge what you can each month to the show, or you can make a one-time annual pledge. The show is an effort that I feel so much gratitude towards with my own research and my own spirit, as well as the spirit and good faith and developed lives of the guests and the concerns and care that you bring to it as listeners. I think it creates something special and important. I think it revivifies conversation as an artful and important and worthwhile contribution to the world. So please do support the show so that it may grow and thrive. Patreon.com/ConorHabib. Thanks for all the love, everybody. Here we go. Hello, everyone. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Welcome back, Caitlin Doty. You are now, I believe, officially my most frequent guest.
Happy Galentine's Day, babe.
So I wanted to talk with you about death, of course, but I want to talk with you about love and love and death. And I was thinking about how to begin the conversation. And I thought the best way would be first to orient ourselves towards what our experience or definitions or whatever of love and death are, respectively, and then kind of bring them together. Because obviously, I mean, they go hand in hand in almost every cultural narrative, art, everything. I mean, they are the themes, or they are the occurrences that we look for in our cultural lives and in our lives. So yeah, that's a mind blower for people. Love and death, they're big themes that you might be familiar with.
I've never heard that said before. That's really profound, Connor. Thank you for for opening that up.
No problem. So for those of you who thought we were going to be reviewing Woody Allen's movie about Russian novels, Love and Death, we won't be doing that. I feel like death is actually going to be easier, which is so ridiculous.
100% death is going to be easier.
I mean, so that's something, first of all, to notice that, like, when we're trying to come to definitions of these things, even though death is so, like, super elusive, obviously you're someone who thinks about it and works with it all the time, but, like, for everybody, it's still kind of elusive, feels like a great unknown or whatever, but it's still easier to define than the thing that we all want to happen to us, or, you know, are excited will happen to us, versus a thing that we're, you know, sort of dreading.
It's extremely chicken or the egg, now that I'm thinking about it, because as someone who is a death worker and a person who thinks about death all day, every day, there is a narrative I have about death and a framework around death that I use, which is that death is the wellspring of all of our lives, that it's the source of all of our lives. The fact that we as humans know that we are going to die one day is the reason that we do everything that we do. It's the reason that we have children and build buildings and cry and create a legacy, is this knowledge that underlies our subconscious mind every single day, that we only have this finite amount of time and we have to get our butts in gear and do something. But when you integrate love into that, the question becomes, is any of that worth it without love? Without the reward of love. And I don't obviously necessarily just mean romantic love or sexual love. The many, many types of love we have, the love that we have for, you know, our weird little hobbies, and the love that we potentially have for our work, and the love that we have for our friends or family. And so, yes, everything that we do, I believe, is based on the fact that we know that we're going to die. But does any of that matter without the potential for loving things or each other?
Yeah. And I mean, right. And so when I think about it that way, I can sort of bring the two together, I think, a little more easily. But let me start with death. Shall I start with death?
Yes, and please, then, please start with death.
And then we'll turn it over to your version. I mean, my experience, and people who listen to the show won't necessarily be shocked by this revelation, but my experience of death is that it's the most meaningful event, singular event that can happen to us, that when we die, it's a intensely meaningful process of losing all the conditions of our incarnation. And we do experience death, and we experience death by dispersing into the constitutive forces of the cosmos. And then over time, in a life between death and the next life, because I accept reincarnation as true, we regather ourselves from those dispersed constitutive forces, and in their dispersion, they've changed. And we kind of redensify and then reincarnate. There's so much more to it than that. But I would just say that, you know, the continuing of the self happens, in my understanding, but the continuing of the incarnation obviously is just done. Although there's an imprint of the incarnation kind of left on the cosmos. So, like, the cosmic forces never forget you, and you can never be forgotten or fully lost. But so that's what happens. Now, I'm obviously talking about death and then rebirth, but that's my understanding of a very simple understanding of death. I could talk about the death of the body, the death of the personality. I could talk about, but if you had to press me to answer in 2 to 3 minutes what death is, that's how I would do it.
My good friend Elua Arthur has a sort of example that she uses when she talks about death, which is that everything in her life and all the life she's lived condenses and condenses and condenses and then explodes in glitter, like into the world, and it disperses. using that as an extremely scientific basis for what you're talking about, is the idea that, as you would see it, that glitter is actually atoms and matter and spiritual sense of self, and that goes out into the world and then recoagulates at some point in different form.
Yeah, and because it had condensed in the address of this incarnation, in some senses you could say that the non-physical aspects, so that the material body, the mineral body, just gets reintegrated into material.
So you think this is all crap? Our body is, like Ernst Becker said, it's worth about like 70 cents.
No, I think it's really beautiful. And obviously, you know, I've had a deep connection to my body in my life and my experience of my body. But I think that it just has a different way of appearing and reintegrating back into the world than the rest of us. Yes, it's like this is much more like we become sand, we become air, we become molecules on a physical sense, sure. But then there are other aspects of us that weave into actually the constitutive forces of material, the ways that material becomes life, the ways that it becomes indwelt by personhood and spirit. And so when we die, those aspects of ourselves are in some sense, this is a metaphor, but they're in some sense magnetized in a way that they're attenuated to find each other again. But when they go out into that cosmic, into all those cosmic forces, they change. They become sort of washed into and blended into those forces. So when they find themselves again, they've totally changed. That's why our incarnated selves have different personalities, different situations. And then, of course, we have different bodies because, you know, they assemble a starting point from a different physical locale.
Can I ask a follow-up question about that? Just based on the sheer number of people that now live on Earth.
Yeah.
And this is, I'm sure, something that happens a lot in circles of people discussing reincarnation or holding this belief. But does that mean that our primary sense of self and our spirit has been watered down because there are so many physical bodies that require something to live in it?
There are a few responses to that. The one that's given sort of most like some burning mysterious question mark is, well, we don't always reincarnate on Earth. So,
okay, good. Yeah, that's a good answer.
You know, so you'll have to like it. That could be one answer. I mean, I think that there's truth to that, but I don't want to necessarily go into what all of that is. Another answer is that we don't always reincarnate into just one self. That you're right. It's not a dilution process exactly, but as materialism becomes more prevalent, we end up, even in our spirits, tending to have more material outcomes. So we can end up reincarnating to more than one person. But then also there's a question of time and time linearity and whether or not our particular moment, and I realize that's a time-bound term, is actually expressing linear time in regards to reincarnation or if it's expressing something else. I think the first answer, I think those are all true in some way, but I think the first answer is actually the most compelling because it's not an excuse in a way. It's not like, yeah, but time's not linear. Yeah, but, you know, like maybe people are just splitting off. Like, I do know some people that have experienced meeting the person that they say they're sharing the incarnation with. And that's been profound experiences for them. But I can't prove the time thing in relation to reincarnation. So I have to sort of incorporate, well, what does this other world thing mean? Because I do also experience that as being true. So
that connects to love in the sense of, do you think that our sacred molecules or untime bound molecules are then attracted to certain people in different time bound moments?
Yeah, For sure. I mean, I think that that's, we make karmic connections with people. And in fact, you know, gosh, well, maybe we'll come back to that one, because I feel like that would really bring up questions of love that I really want to go into. And maybe I don't want to go totally down that path right now, but I would just say, yes, karmically, we end up intertwining in some ways in our existence with people that we love. So when we die, there's actually some, we say, imprinting or tangling up or whatever in our existence as we move back into those forces. So we end up finding each other. And that doesn't just have to be a love. That can be, in a psychoanalytic term, just an intensely enjoyable experience, an experience that is just overwhelming, that creates a sort of shock entanglement between people.
Well, that's, and I'll let you answer this later. You can take this question off the air, but it's sort of interesting to think about, you know, you and I being very, very good friends for a long time now. And, you know, me being a cranky nihilist, which I can go into my version of death. And, you know, it's like, are your molecules and your karmic, ability is trying to intertwine with mine. And I'm just like, meh. Or you're like, sorry, it's happening whether you like it or not. You know, there's like, you know, our connection is on this other level, even if you believe that you are doing a different, I mean, this is kind of a question for love in a really profound way too, is how often we have relationships with people and the two people are doing just completely different things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're coming from completely different perspectives. And I don't mean like Democrat and Republican. I mean like, you know, one person is like, has been reincarnated and the other person hasn't, or yeah. Like one person has like a profound spiritual sense of the world and the other person is like, I like McDonald's or whatever, you know, just like Right. Very totally different primary perspectives. And like, who is to say that you haven't been reincarnated many, many times and I haven't?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's definitely has to be true in a sense, because what if you've lived longer lives than I have? Then you're reincarnating less just by, you know, the nature of time itself, you'd be reincarnating less. Whereas, you know, if someone's reincarnating as a baby, you know, that dies a year in, then obviously they're going to come back more quickly. And there's a whole, this is just information. I don't experience this, but the information about reincarnation that I would trust says like, there's this whole kind of timeline for how long the in-between life lasts as well in relation to how long the, you know, incarnated life lasts. But I hate talking about stuff like that because it's just info. And then people are like, they start dissecting and I'm like, well, I don't actually know if that part of it's true. I just heard it and it sounded right, you know?
Mm. Well, what's interesting about that, and I can go in a little bit into my definition of death here, is that, you know, you and I have been, as I said, friends for a really long time, which is just a humble brag for me. I'm just like, you know, just kind of like totally my just great friend. You know, we've had so many of these conversations and I am really, as I've said, and I really do believe this to be true, I am open to some of that to resonate with me, you mm-hmm. know, and to hit me and to go like, absolutely, you're right. I can see how that works. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you view it, my definition of death is actually quite, I call it a kind of beautiful nihilism, I guess, in the sense that I believe that humans are no different than animals. And of course, many people believe that animals reincarnate and have much broader emotional lives than we often give them credit for. But I think that humans are very much like animals, that we die in the same way as animals. Maybe we have more, alongside other certain types of species of animals, have a more deeply relational and love relationship and family relationship that we do mourn. And that sets us apart than all animals. But we are essentially fighting for the same things on Earth, fighting for the same resources. And we just happen to be the most rapacious animals that have ever lived on this particular planet. And when we die, however, and that's the nihilism, but when we die, I really do believe that the organic matter that makes up our body, the fact that we are animals and that we are, you know, creatures, that we are creaturely, we are embodied and creaturely, and we have this dead flesh that is not disgusting. It is not gross. It is matter. It is material. It is food for other animals, potentially. It is food for trees. It is food for new growth. It is potential to become soil, to become more, and to reintegrate in just the basic, you know, Gaia fabric of Earth. And that is a really profound and beautiful thing. But I consider my nihilism to be humility around death, in the sense that, like, the nihilism of just like, I am this creature, this species, this animal, like any other, I am meant to fight for the same resources that all other animals do, and then die and recycle my atoms back into this cycle. And you can look at that in a very nihilistic way, you know, life is, you know, nasty, brutish and short kind of way, or you can look at it in a, I am part of the cycle sort of way. Yeah. Isn't that quite lovely? I think it's interesting though, that we can have, you know, that you and I can have such like profound, this is what I was saying, such profoundly different understandings of like how we got here and what our sense of self living in the world is, and still be, you know, like LOL this meme or whatever, you know, with some just talking about some stupid shit.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually it's a pretty wonderful point of connection where there's, you know, where we can sort of point to love and friendship, because I'm not threatened by any of that with you. It's not, well, threatened as I wouldn't be threatened by it with anybody, but it doesn't threaten our relationship in the least for me. And of course, and I'm sure you feel this way too, like there's a part of me that's like, well, she'll find out, you know, like there's definitely that sense. But I think for me, I have no desire to try to force people to believe in the stuff I say. And I used to, when I was younger, of course, I always wanted to win the argument or whatever, but I've pretty much left the realm of argument unless there's an urgent political concern that I think I can contribute to by dissecting someone else's point of view. And especially with people I care about, I've just sort of been like, the argument is so unnecessary because the freedom is what actually is more important. And there is no argument in freedom. There's no argument in freedom and compassion, which are basically the two components of love in my understanding. So there's no argument there. And so in my mind, we're all unified in spirit, you know, and you're saying in some ways we're all unified in matter, you know?
But also like less for me, less than like you'll find out is more like, okay, if you die, Connor, and you are spread out into glitter or atoms or karmic particles.
Funfetti, yeah.
Funfetti. And that I can get behind. Hold on. and you spread out and then you karmically align with spirits and then you reconstitute in this way back on Earth. Like, okay, vibe. Good for you. I hope that works out, you know? Like, yeah. I hope that's how it goes for you. Why not? Like, I don't have a strong I think the reason that I'm so focused on matter and human matter and death is that my work is the corpse. You know, my work is what happens to the corpse and the importance of the corpse and how we can focus reform to take care of our planet and each other better through the magic of the dead body. And so what happens with spirit to me is lovely. It's just not, it's so much less urgent to me.
Yeah, well, that's how I've always kind of viewed, and I hope this sounds like okay. I think I've probably said this to you before personally, but that's kind of how I viewed your positioning in it, is like, actually, your ability to really do the deep and important work you do requires that focus and concentration. You know, if you were, it's not that you wouldn't be open to other things, but it's like when I remember Lynn Margulies saying to me, like when I went to this talk with her in New Mexico at the Lindisfarne Association, and this guy William Aaron Thompson's talking about encountering angels. And after we left, you know, I was like, Lynn, I was like, what do you think of that? And she's like, oh, it's just not scientific enough for me. And all she meant by that was not that, I mean, she really respected Bill, like it had nothing to do with that. She was just like, I actually don't have time. Like, I cannot engage in that because I've got so much other stuff to do, you know? And I think that that, you know, really, really resonated with me and really made sense. And I just felt such a deep regard for that stance, because it was like, what are you going to do? I mean, and she was the smartest person I've ever met. So there was no questioning of her inability to access the things I was accessing or anything like that. It was like, all right, hands off. Like, you do your thing, because I cannot even touch the things that you're thinking about.
That makes so much sense. And that makes so much sense for someone like her. And I think I understand that. And I think a lot of, you know, when you look at young, now that I'm slightly older, now that I'm not the it generation anymore, I can look at younger advocates and people, and, you know, and this is maybe just me being grumpy, but my note is always just like, narrow it down, narrow it down, you plucky young folk. Like,
yeah.
Pick a lane. And I know that it's, of course, when you're 22, it's incredibly hard to pick a lane, because to have the sort of absolutely focused, intense passion on a particular thing, you really got to hook up with a particular thing that you're ready to ride into the sunset, which me is a corpse, which is a strange analogy. But it is like when you're just like, if your thing is like climate change, you know, right, all the injustices, mm-hmm, you know, politics, it's like, that's right. That is,
you have to be the person that can handle that. Like, you have to be Leonardo da Vinci or someone like that. That's like, yes, I can actually hold 8 million things at once. And that's a very rare human being.
Rare human being. And, or you have to be like a politician who very rarely can do that in any sort of artful way at all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And even then they're usually applying it through the lens of politics, which is not,
right,
you know, but I have a question that's come out of what you said about death, but I want to ask you, or maybe make one more observation before I move to that question, is like, I think it's given to some people to work mostly with the material world. So what I mean by that is, you know, in occult understanding, there's what we can go into this or not, but there's the material body, the etheric body, the astral body, and then the ego. But the material body is the stuff that we're made out of. And the material body isn't aspiritual. It's deeply spiritual. And it has its own spiritual life. And one of the aspects of its spiritual life is the way that you describe death and the death process and the reintegration and the way that the material world is always commingling with itself and reforming itself and finding new relationship amongst just actual stuff. And I do think that some people, you know, if you're a botanist or you're, you know, a zoologist, you might work with the etheric body or the astral body by working with plants or animals respectively. So I think that some people, when you talk about narrowing, they're given to working with a certain kingdom, and they do that. And to be able to do that well, you just have to keep going in and in and in and deepening your capacity for it. And I think one of the problems when you're talking about narrowing is like, people a lot of times they diversify things because they want novelty, and therefore their engagement with the world just becomes the pleasure of new experience. I'm all for the pleasure of new experience. That's great. And I wouldn't deny anybody's like ability to do that. However, it does sometimes limit the aptitude for deepening capacity. And that's what I see. You're like deepening your capacity, corpses all the way down, basically.
Oh, yeah. it's corpses all the way down.
You know?
But also, to be clear, without having in the Lynn Margulies school, not having the time to spend in the ethereal as deeply as maybe even I would like or would be interesting for me in one human lifetime, I still consider the moment that a living human becomes a corpse, not even the moment in the sense of some sort of spiritual transition, but the actual state of being a corpse to be the most spiritual state a human can be in. And the most, in some senses, the most useful that human will ever be. And that's I'm not saying like some people are better off dead. That's not what I mean. But what I do mean is that if you are living in community and the community is able to use your fresh corpse, the time right after you die until the week, a week or so after your death, until they have to do something with your dead body, cremate, bury, excarnate, whatever it is, that is such a profound opportunity, especially if you have relationships within the community and your death leaves a hole. The repair and the ritual that has to go on around your dead body is probably the most profound, more than weddings, more than childbirth, more than, birthdays, more than any other, even religious ceremonies and holidays, more than any other time in most cultures. That period right after death presents such a profound opportunity for ritual, for redefining our sense of self, for strengthening bonds. It's just really such an important time that I would call sacred. That that for me doesn't necessarily have to do anything have to do with where that person's soul is going.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I agree with you, except for the very last part of it, because I would say that's actually where, like, so what I would say in my understanding. So I'm going to say agree, disagree. Like, I would just say my understanding of that moment is that, when someone dies, everything they were becomes available to others. And so whereas they were condensed into the physical address of their body before, we experience them moving into the constitutive forces by having this translation of, oh, they're not occupying the address in the same way anymore. There's still an aspect of them there, their visage, what we have to do with them, the way we can still touch them, and so on and so forth. But it's like when people say, well, he's in your heart now, or he's in your thoughts, or, she's like the book, the Tim O'Brien, she's like the book that you take down off the shelf and you read it. She's there whenever you want to access her or whatever it is. It's like you have this ability, at that point to actually experience someone in a completely new way. And it's because they've gone through a deep transformative process where they've become part of you in a way that they couldn't have when they were in the physical form. And so for me, that moment is defined by grief. And to the extent that we can grieve, the more we can understand that someone has come to be with us in a new way. And so the translation of the condensed address of a human being into the dispersed version of them happens in grief and in grieving.
Absolutely. But I think that the dead human body being present, and this is what I hear so often, and obviously I have a bias because this is my work. So I'm always like hearing these stories and focusing on these stories. But the experience of, the vast difference between, my son went to war and just never returned,
right,
and his body was a mystery and he disappeared and I never saw or heard from him again. The difference between the way that grief intensifies and lingers in something like that situation versus My dad died within community, and we were all able to be there, you know, either when he died or right after he died. And we had some sort of ritual around his body. We washed his body. We were there to put him on the cremation pyre. Yeah. You know, we lowered him. We dug the grave and lowered him into the grave. The difference between how grief resolves, and grief never totally resolves, but the difference between how grief moves forward and how quickly it moves forward, if you have that period of time with the dead body and that ritual and that material mixed with spiritual, you know, mixed with ritual time, how just vastly, vastly different that person, the griever feels 2 weeks, 2 months after it's happened is absolutely profound.
Totally. I mean, I completely agree with that. I mean, even in like the death process with my mom, you know, I mean, she just died over a long period of time. So it's not like we kept the corpse in the house, but she died over years, you know, and she was just wasting away for the last few weeks, especially, and, you know, comatose, basically. So it felt like I was with a body, and, you know, then she died and there was a big difference. But I'm so glad I had that time with her in that form of becoming the corpse, you know, like really visibly becoming the corpse, because it wasn't going to be, you know, an open casket for her or anything like that. And I think that for me, I want to be careful the way I word this, because I don't actually want to sound, I don't want to sound glib in any way. And I don't want to, I don't want this to sound like I'm diminishing the importance of the body, but for me, it's saying, you know, being able to say goodbye to the body is a way of saying hello to the spirit, you know, and to the extent that you don't get to say goodbye to the body, like that you don't get to actually, as someone who is themselves, a, you know, as you say, future corpse, someone who's becoming that state each day, you know, it becomes much harder, I think, for people, especially in our time. I mean, in lots of times, but especially in our time when, you know, we're really, really materialistic in so many ways, that touching and that being with and that making decisions around and regarding, you know, and holding in high regard, I think, to the extent that that brings us together and allows us to say goodbye to it, that's when we get to actually go to spirit. And that's why I'm saying grieving. It's not just, or maybe mourning. I actually not sure how you would maybe distinguish those two terms if you think there is a distinction, but like rather than just letting go or getting through it, or, you know what I mean? It actually, your heart does need to be broken in the process, really.
Yeah. But I like what you said about, you know, saying goodbye to the body and hello to the spirit, because even if you, I think that you can come to it, there's in some ways very specific ways that you can come to like, hey, it's the wake with the dead body. And that's one really beautiful way to frame it, especially if you have a spiritual sense of self. But I think another, if you were looking for a more secular way to describe almost basically the same thing, it would be to say goodbye, instead of goodbye to the body, hello to the spirit, like goodbye to the body, hello to the new reality. You know, but you're kind of describing the same thing.
Yeah.
In that, and you and I may have different, or you and me and, you know, millions of other people who have experienced the same thing on earth may have different versions of what's going on, but it's still the essential feeling of a transition that is the most profound part of being a human.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of overlay there, and some of the differences are semantic. Some of them are real differences, but some of them are just the articulation that brings a sense of meaning to people who don't believe in reincarnation or experience it, and the kinds of articulation that brings sense of meaning to someone who does, or someone who's longing to. I do think that maybe there are differences in what talking with the dead might mean, what setting yourself up for your next incarnation might mean, that kind of stuff. And I think maybe we can go there when we talk about this a little bit more. But one of the questions I had along the way here was, how has your view of death changed? It does seem to have moved a bit. And I don't mean like coming around to Connor's way. But I mean, like, it seems to have changed. And I don't know if it's post From Here to Eternity, where you were just spending time with people who had vastly different death rites that still had very similar aspects to them, or if it, you know, but I have noticed a little bit of a change in the way you talk about things. And so I'm just wondering if what the change is, if you can articulate it.
Well, I mean, what do you see as the change? Because I'm like, I don't know. Well, I mean, maybe I do, but I'm interested to hear what you say.
Well, I mean, part of this comes from private conversation where I notice a kind of, how do I say, like a willingness to engage with spiritual things a bit more in life. So then I can sort of hear it a little bit when you talk about death a little bit too. And so it's actually hard for me to articulate, which is why I'm asking you, because I do kind of sense a difference. But for people who don't know, I mean, I must have met you in 2013, I think, or something like that. So it's been like 10 years or 9 years since we first had our public conversation about sex and death at this medical clinic in California, which is really funny. But I think it seems like I want to stress that I'm not saying that you're coming closer to what I believe in, but it seems like there's been an opening in a way that it seemed like there was a kind of, I don't know, an absoluteness 10 years ago that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. I mean, well, okay. So 10 years ago, I was 27, 28, you know, and I was starting.
She was 35, everyone. That's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's be real. I mean, I'd rather have been older and not look as haggard, you know, would be the ideal. But I'd love for people to say like, oh my God, you look so young for what your actual age is, which they don't. So yeah, I think that I, you know, talking about younger people and their transition into activism or how they see the world, you know, I had been in the funeral industry by the time I met you for, I guess, 6 years or something. But I had just really in the past 2 or so years become a public advocate for reform in the funeral industry and how we look at the dead body and death. And I was coming up against just sort of constant pushback from this industry that's extremely, you know, dominated by capitalism, dominated by men at the time and really still today at the highest levels. And they all thought I was this sort of horrific ingenue who was there to spread misinformation and was just like dabbling in this. And they still say that sometimes, which is so funny because, you know, I'm certainly no ingenue anymore. But I give all this introduction to just say that I think that you feel required emotionally to have a stringency and specificity to your arguments when you're up against that. And that's kind of your daily practice and advocacy is to be talking about these things against really stiff pushback. And I feel like because I have a much larger audience now and because it's much more well understood, the advocacy that I'm advocating for, just in general culture, I think, in the zeitgeist, it's much easier for me to just be chiller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like really deep spiritual relationships. That seems fun. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really the change is just me being like, you know, oh, that seems it. When Connor says stuff, sometimes I'm like, okay, God bless you, Connor. You know, God bless my weird little dear friend. And then sometimes I'm like, you know what? Yeah, why not? That seems great. That seems not even like that seems great, but like that seems like that framework would help me.
Yeah,
for sure. Like that framework would help me be a better advocate just because it would make me a better person. And there's nothing, you know, I'm not deeply attached to my nihilism. It's just that evidence always seems to like push me in that direction, whether I like it or not. But any opportunity I can find to have a much more integrated, lovely, spiritual, Gaia version of the world, I would prefer.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think it's so interesting because I think like I was thinking about you and Peter Rollins and I did an event right before I moved to Ireland called God, Sex, Death. And I remember someone saying like, cause I gave some present, talked about death a little bit and talked about, you know, from my perspective, death doesn't actually happen in the way that we does. And I remember getting this like super like scientific pushback from someone in the audience without like sort of detailing what that was. And I felt kind of like, it was interesting the way I felt sort of on edge, to cope with the materialism of an audience that wasn't mine. Well, it was my audience then too, but like, I feel like there's a lot more room now for exploration of the spiritual stuff and not the physical alone when it comes to death and death discussions. And I think that a lot of that actually is a result of your advocacy, which is very interesting to me because like, part of what you've done is that you've brought a lot more voices to the discussion about what happens with corpses and death care. And a lot of those are coming from different communities and different ethnic and racial and gender expression backgrounds and so on and so forth. So we're now getting like a whole like slew of different perspectives that actually it's like the you know, sciencey version of things, it's still in the room, but it can't like quite step on other voices as much. And I think that that's something that you've done.
It's a transition from like very stringent capitalist cookie cutter death customs in America to more room. So, you know, if you walk in and it's a, you know, you went to the local corporate funeral home and you walk in and you mom disappeared, was whisked away right after she died. And then you see her and she's fully embalmed and made up in a casket. And you walk up and you kind of touch her hand, which seems a little waxy. And she's wearing a strange lipstick you've never seen her wear before. And she has a strange facial expression. And then you just go sit down. Nothing happens. Mm. Absolutely. No, nothing happens. There's no ritual. There's no transition. She's not there in the room with you. It's just this uncanny valley, strange feeling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people can have a great old time with an embalmed body, but that's not the majority of folks, at least not anymore. And so the transition, I think, is much more just like, hey, and this is why we kind of talk about me having to have a base level of just, you know, my thing is like, hey, someone dies. Keep them there, hang out in the room. What's happening? What's going on? What's going on for you? And mom can be having a different spiritual experience than the daughter.
Right.
You know, like a whole unique culture can share in a ritualistic or grief experience. Like, but it's just having the very basic level of like, let's get the corpse out of these kind of vaguely corporate capitalistic clutches and put them out there. And let what happens, that it leads to exactly what you're saying, all sorts of different voices and different reflections and different experiences and different religions and different spiritualities and different senses of what's happening after death are allowed to express themselves.
Well, okay. Let's move on to love now.
To love.
And that we could sort of bring the two together a little bit more. I haven't thought about defining love in the way that I've thought about defining death and the afterlife, the in-between life, and reincarnation.
Which is strange because it's just as threatening.
Oh, it's way scarier in a lot of ways, right? Like it's because it's so terrifying. to people, because when you encounter love, it illuminates everything that's not love in your life. And that's a really terrifying prospect. But I think also because it's so generalized for me, like a really base statement that I could make is like, well, you know, love is everything, but actually everything emerges from love. It's not even something that you can point to. It's actually just the sort of wellspring of all existence. And there are lots of ways that I could sort of filter down and talk about that. But I think that that's where I would start. If someone asked me on the spot, I'd be like, well, I guess it's, I guess it's everything, you know? And that, you know, even contains in its way for me. And I think maybe this is a difference, but contains life and death for me. It's like, those are smaller than love. And I have my ways of talking about that, and in physical ways and spiritual ways as well. Like that, you know, sex existed before life existed, for instance, like from a scientific definition. And, you know, therefore like death probably didn't, you know, like the things were never dead until they were, you know, alive and then died. And so what does that mean? And so where does that, all that come from? Comes from the sort of rain outward of love. But look, you know, like this is going to air on Valentine's Day, so that's not the only kind of love we're talking about. We're not talking about the big cosmic love, you know? And when I think about that love I have for my boyfriend, you know, or my friends, or like you said, hobbies, or just the love I have for Ireland, and all these different ways of articulating the presence of love, I think I'm always moving towards that bigger love. It's like I'm always trying to open and open and open to more of that. When I really am committed to the love I'm feeling, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, there's something to connect it to death. There is something in that. There is no grief without love. Mm-hmm. Right. And no, you're not, I mean, you could argue that, you know, your father is, say, you know, or your mother is abusive and they die. But even then, like, you grieve them, even though it's extremely complicated, because love is bound up mm-hmm. with betrayal and maybe hatred or whatever you're feeling. And there's something in there about loss and about mourning and about how I was thinking earlier when we were talking about, and I'm sorry if this is too scientific, but the idea of species that have a sense of community and family, orcas, elephants, you know, chimpanzees, humans, your animals that have a broader sense of understanding and self-awareness and love. And there are more, but that really do grieve when mm-hmm. one of their family members dies, and how, you know, how that might be different than like ants, where, you know, the ant dies, and they did a studies on this, then ant dies and the other ants just walk around it. They just step over it. They don't care that it's dead until it starts emitting a chemical called oleic acid. And then once that smell happens, they spring into action and they go, okay, like time to haul it up and cart it off and put it in the ant cemetery area, you know, and they know it. And you can paint a little living ant with oleic acid. And they do that to the, they like do the little funeral ritual for the living ant. And the ant's like, hello. It's me, Steve, I'm alive. You know, and sort of that shows that we probably have a pretty different understanding of what death and grief and love looks like than ants do, for instance. But there are animals that we really profoundly overlap with. And there are relationships, orcas, for instance, who have expanded limbic systems and parts of their emotional regulation in their brain that have connections with their family that we cannot understand.
Right.
That have connections and feelings and understandings and probably some, not to anthropomorphize, but love for each other that our brains are not capable of doing, which is sort of, that's humbling in itself, right? The idea that like there are creatures that love more than us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like that shouldn't be upsetting to people. There are people who are more capable of love than others, or rather who have developed the capacity of love that's available to most of us, I would say, you know, than others. Right. And then there are people who, you know, sociopaths who, at least as far as we understand now, are completely cut off from that experience, you know, and maybe that's not true. Maybe there actually is love available in a different way, but like the actual personal experience of love, the animals are really interesting, you know, for me, because I think the way we observe them has a lot to do with, or not the way we observe them, the way that they express themselves has a lot to do with like which ones are closest to individuation in the same way that human beings are, whereas ants are clearly not the same kind of individuals, you know, that orcas are. And dogs even aren't the same way orcas are. Dogs seem to really overlap with us and pick up that kind of, like we were talking about before, the entanglement that you can have with another person. A dog can really have that in a way that starts to make their behaviors even resemble ours. But I don't think that that's the same as the orca, who, and maybe dolphins and some other animals, where you can actually see them as a species that's in the process of individuation. Whereas I think most animals have a collective self that's not really here, that the way
Rudolph's right,
yeah.
But oh, sorry, I didn't mean to. I know you want to drop that Rudolph. Yeah. I just want to say that, like, I think it's actually sort of a good pushback at point to be like, you know, the ants, this collective love, you know, is, who is to say that the love of individuation is more powerful than the love of a group that's acting as a collective?
Yeah. Well, I'll say that, because I think,
and in fact, Rudolf Steiner would say that.
Well, no, I mean, I would say that the ants, in some way you could say that's an expression of self-love. It's an expression of love that's happening within the single organism of all the ants. So it's not that it's not love. It's just not love for the other, which is a different kind of love. Because again, if I think that love is sort of rain out into everything, like I could view that as an act of love, even though the signal to it is kind of akin to a signal that we might see in our brains when we're in love with somebody. You know, that's what it's an acid moving from one place to another. I don't think that that signal means that it's just a chemical reaction. I think that the chemical reaction is the sign of a spiritual truth, but it's something that's happening within, and it's happening within an organism that has much more of a single organ kind of presence, you know, that's gathering around itself as an organ. Whereas I think an orca or a dolphin or a human being, and I didn't used to think this about dolphins or orcas, but it seems like they're almost, I could agree that they are individuals in the same way that human beings are.
Or individuals in more advanced ways.
Yeah, totally. In ways that we just don't even get. But I think that's right. I mean, like they're in some ways, I think, loving the other, which is, it requires a sense of separation that I think, that to me is when we talk about love, a lot of times we're talking about, I know that you're not me, which is not something that we ever have proof for. I can't ever prove that you're not just part of me, but that I say that you aren't part of me indicates that I love you, you know, because I'm saying you must exist. You must have experiences that are private from me that I can't get into. And yet like here we are. I mean, I think that for me is part of the definition of what love is, which is why when people talk about having a partner, you know, or a husband, a wife, whatever, they'll be like, it's a lot of work. And, you know, you can't expect that person to do the same things as you or see things the same way as you or whatever, Because in a lot of ways, that is the definition of being in love with someone, is granting them the access to not be you and not be like you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a way to look at love from an individualistic, like Connor, here I am perspective? Mm-hmm. Is there a way to look at love that is not selfish?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is like, tell me a little bit more.
Sure. I guess what I mean by that, as you were talking, I was listening to you, but also thinking about how even the type of spiritual love that one may wish to have, love for the greater universe, love for people who have come before and after, love for even people who hate me, you know, that all of those type of loves that are not like you can it's more obvious to be like, this is my partner and I love them so much, and that's very selfish because I love them because they're the best. Like there's a real selfishness to that. Doesn't mean you can't be very generous, but there's an inherent selfishness to that. But even when you're talking about love for the greater universe and just practicing love in your daily life, isn't that in some ways tied up with a sort of like self-improvement?
Oh,
that is inherently selfish.
I see. For sure, a lot of loving stuff, a lot of love has to do with, yeah, self-development, which I would distinguish from spiritual development. Spiritual development, which feels less about the self in the way you're talking about, it still relates to the self, but it's not necessarily contained by the self, requires accepting the presence of an other and in others love that you cannot even sort of begin to define. I think that might be part of the way that I would express the difference between spiritual development and self-development. It's moving within something that you know is always going to be ahead of you, a real mystery. It's just a hard question to answer.
So when I look at religions, or even spirituality, there's something to me in the kind of like, I was lost, I feel lost, and I want to come to this religion and be found, and I do this through selflessness. Mm. But then I'm like, is that really selflessness?
Right.
Right. Like, is giving, like, it seems like you're kind of looking for like a 12-step program that religion gives you.
Yeah.
That, you know, like I'm not trying to be snide here. I'm genuinely asking, like, is there a way to come to religious and to religion or to spirituality and to come with that kind of humble devotional love that is not come from a place of ultimately like, I want to feel better and I want to feel held.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think of so much spiritual development, real spiritual development requires like tons of suffering and pain. So I don't think it actually goes through, you know, I mean, there is, of course, a comfort in it as well. Like, as there's often a dance between comfort and pain. You know, even people who are just totally secular, you know, like, have no belief in God, if something bad happens, they'll say, why is this happening to me? As if an answer is accessible to them. So they'll be dancing between, is there purpose? No, there's no purpose. Why am I experiencing this? Wait, why am I asking that if there is no why? I mean, there's a dance back and forth. And I think that there's a dance between the becoming someone who engages with spiritual development that is not just about self-development and self-care. That's a process. In the same way that, you know, Buddhist, you know, I always have issues with Buddhism, the same way I have issues with other religions, but people seem to give Buddhism a pass so much. I don't know why. But one of the things that's always irritated me about the way people talk about it is like, well, you know, you just meditate to get rid of desire. And I'm like, yeah, but don't you want to do that? Like, why? Why
are you like desire?
Yeah, oh, I can't wait to get rid of my desire. You know, but like, there's a difference between the becoming process, where yes, you still are feeling that, and then getting on a side of it where actually you've moved past the process. And so I think yes, the foothold and the path to a lot of spiritual development and religion is, you know, that path of tangles and vines and everything that starts with saying, well, yeah, I want to be cared for. I want to feel the love of someone else. And it's actually one of the sort of biggest things to get past is projecting onto the world. I see spirits in nature everywhere, and the trees and the grass and the rivers and whatever, because you don't want to be lonely, right? So you just say that because you don't want to be lonely. That is actually the pathway to seeing that you've decided somewhere in you upon the truth that that's possible. So that's where the truth lies behind actually the move, which is shallow. So it's getting rid of these processes until you're in the actual truth of it. Because I think we know the truth underneath the selfless action we take to reveal the truth to ourselves.
I see what you're saying, that there is a truth that it sort of doesn't matter how we get there if there is a truth that underlies it.
Yeah, I mean, not all, it does matter how we get there, but, you know, like, I mean, just like I wouldn't want someone to come to the truth that killing people is wrong by killing five people, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. the truth is, you know, it does matter how we get there, and it can impact other people. But I think that is usually what happens for most of the things we do in our lives. I mean, we will treat people that we're with and in love with like shit until we realize that, like, fuck, that hurt them and they don't want me to do that anymore. Okay, I guess I'm not going to do it. But you just couldn't know that. And you couldn't know how to engage with the other until you heard from them, you know?
Well, you also, I think in relationships, whether friendships or partnerships or probably, honestly, spiritual relationships, there's this period of time that it's just very difficult to trust their intentions. So when something, and you know, and whether that's like your spiritual leader or your boyfriend or whoever it is, you're like, okay, when they do this thing that makes me suffer, are they doing it because they enjoy my suffering? Or are they doing it because either they don't have bad intentions and they don't know how it affects me, or it's this part of suffering for goodness? And that they have positive, like, it's really hard to know that.
And am I suffering because I want to, or because I am actually suffering as a result of this? Like, how much of this is me wanting to be in struggle and pain and exhibit it and perform it and all that? And what does that give me, you know? And like that, I mean, that's the psychoanalytic gambit, is like, when someone says, I just want to be heard. Actually, what they're saying is, I just want to be hurt. You know, it's like you could hear the overlap. But I think maybe we've moved past you telling me what you think love is. So so I'd like to hear at least the sort of stirrings of that, you know.
Oh,
hide behind ants and orcas.
Yeah. She's always just like, do you want to hear an orca fact? It's like, no, I want to hear your truth. Well, okay. So there was this pod of orcas off Seattle.
And Willie.
Yeah. Off the San Juan Islands. J72, K45. Yes. What do I think of love? Well, I mean, we were kind of alluding to this at the beginning, but I do think that my love or sense of love does live in the same universe as death, for sure, in the sense that it's a beautiful nihilism. Like, I think that love is created by scientific forces. I think it is created by evolution, and I think it is created by all of us evolving in this certain way to benefit these certain traits. But I also think that it's the thing that makes death hard, and thus it's the thing that makes death beautiful, and thus it's the thing that makes the cycle of life and death beautiful. Because if you don't have love, or if you don't have connection, then we are just the ants getting, you know, when we start to emit our little oleic acid, we get carted off and dumped, you know, and there is something beautiful in the fact that we're not just part of a collective, because I don't think that's the answer either, that we're just like all part of this like beautiful ebb and flow of a mass collective. Like, no, we're not. We're extremely like selfish, volatile, individualistic little creatures. Mm. And how selfish, volatile, individualistic creatures navigate love and the degrees which we can have passion and projection and fear around love is pretty special. It can be like annoying and terrible, but it's also pretty special and pretty unique to us in so many ways. And I love that for us. but I mean, I also think about how much I use this as an example. I say, you know, your relationship, people will say like, oh, you have such a good relationship with death. And I just try and acknowledge that every time something big happens in your life, whether it's losing a job or moving or falling in love, your relationship with death changes. And you have a good foundation, but you have to go through it again. Those things I don't think are all created equal. I think falling in love for most people is the thing, or maybe having a child are the thing, which is kind of falling in love essentially, are the things that most profoundly alter your relationship with death at any given time. And because I look through love in this deathy lens, I think the maybe most interesting thing I have to offer about love is just making clear that a lot of what you're going through when you fall in love is connected to your changing relationship with death. And a lot of the fear that you feel and a lot of the terror and like sense of your sense of self shifting and molding to this new person and the fact that this is now a person that you've brought into your life who could die. You know, this is true for a new partner and for a new child that could die at any moment and take your whole sense of self with them. Is a really profound thing that needs to be looked at and given space.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we should talk about the death of a loved one. And loving the dead, you know, as well. But I want to say something just to jump off of one of the points you were making, where it's like, I don't necessarily think being a collective is, you know, that's where it's all at. I think that's actually something that we do experience when we die. Like, I would say that like the kingdom of death is the only place where communism is real, where actually, you know, when the experience that people have when they have NDEs, a lot of times is they're like, I just felt this complete sense of absolute love. Not everybody says that, but that's a big part of the, you know, percentage of the thing that people experience there. Some people have horrible experiences, but the huge majority of people, whether it affects their lives positively or not afterwards, they'll report this feeling of absolute love. And I've always viewed that, well, not always, but I viewed that for a long time as this sense of the radical contingency of every single person that, in fact, far from being sort of arbitrarily here or that we're randomly here, the universe doesn't care if we're here or not. Even from a secular viewpoint, if you take one part out of reality, you can't have reality. And when you die and you're moving back into those constitutive forces, you're sensing that all that could not have existed without your presence. And that's where you start blending into everybody else, or maybe in the physical or the material ways that you talked about it, when we start sort of blending back into the substance of everything is when we achieve something that is actually kind of like true communism. And I mean that as a positive. I don't mean that as a negative, like communism is just death. Like, I don't mean it like that. I mean that as a positive. And I think that that's where a lot of the idea of communism comes from is, you know, it regards itself as a political critique, but actually it's economic. It's a question about the all the resources where everything, or I'm sorry, regards, I should have said it differently. It regards itself as an economic critique, but it's actually just an economic description. It's a description of the all where everything comes from, the breaks and flows and the ways everything sort of moves in and out. And I think I'm bringing all that up just to say that life has an obviously much more individuated sense to it than death does. And that shouldn't be circumstantial. And one of the reasons, and we shouldn't just say, well, we need to all become a collective. Actually, part of what living is recognizing that self and other and that separation. And love is only really possible through the sense of separation. And I think it's a really beautiful thing about death is that a new sense of separation occurs and a new sense of togetherness occurs, this new relationship, this new reality, as you say. And so a new form of love then becomes available.
With near-death experiences, something that's interesting about that, though, is that in studies that they've done, who you see as you walk down the tunnel of light, like who is waiting for you, is extremely dependent on your individualistic experience. Mm-hmm. So if you are Hindu, there's like a Hindu god riding a motorcycle.
Yeah.
You know, like putting, you know, or if you're, you know, or it's your mom or it's Jesus and that very much, you know, with the bleeding heart out to you, like it very much depends on the symbology that you're aware of, which sort of, I mean, there's just such a way that you can look at that as also being created by a brain and the flood of white light being oxygen that's, you know, and the, you know, causing the tunnel vision, like the same thing that fighter pilots have. Mm. As they push through, they have that same sort of tunnel of white light when they're losing oxygen and they're moving really fast. You know, is that? It, yeah, I feel like such a curmudgeon here, but like, is my thought on this is that we absolutely should be looking for the collective and the beauty and the love to be found there, but are we looking for it in the wrong places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there's a lot of research about NDEs that scientifically would like go against some of that. But I think about it being that kind of brain experience because of varieties of experience. And the only reason I'm saying that is because we're going to end the show soon and I didn't want to let it lie. Like, but I'm not. I also think that you're right in saying that it is all conditioned. You know, it is definitely all conditioned in
right.
a way.
Right. Well, I want to do is I guess like even in the, I'm not necessarily even denying the like communism of death, which I think is interesting, but it's like even in death, like I want there to be some grand collective. And I do think that as we've kind of go back to, it's found in matter and nature and what's like available to us in our physical bodies. And that's our reincarnation for me. But does that change the fact that we have incredibly individual deaths?
Yeah, right. That's a really hard thing to contend with. And I think that for spiritual people, I think it becomes something difficult to contend with because I think people want to just be like, oh, we all just go back into light and don't worry, you're going to be reborn and all that kind of stuff. And of course, there's deep value in this incarnation, in this individual self, and marking it as something that is just going to pass and come back anyway. Like, it doesn't really take care of being able to be in love with this incarnation or the incarnation of your own mother, you know, and not wanting that mother to die and like go away and having to confront all of that. And I think we can see very quickly that like that collective version of things can't live up to the sense of loss we feel when an individual goes. And in fact, the ways that that can be so much more acute than tons of people dying. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that kind of leads to the question of like, why, if we really are this cosmic collective, why bother building intense personalized relationships, love relationships?
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, I think that one of the ways of talking about that is that the laws of nature are themselves evolving. So it's not just the organisms or the plants or even biosphere, but the laws of nature are evolving. And one of the evolutionary innovations is freedom. And that's a component of love. And so what I mean by evolve might be a little different. I don't mean that I don't believe in evolution, but I mean, like, what I mean by evolve here might be a little different than what people are thinking, like some weird natural selection process on the natural laws or whatever. But part of that freedom component requires individuation as far as we can see it. I mean, look, if someone's got a better way of telling me how it can work without us being individuals, that's fine. But the sort of interaction of people that feel separate from each other, I think it's something that Christianity points to really deeply when it's like that person on the cross is not you, you know, and yet you strive to understand that person. And when you strive to understand that person, that's where you meet them. Not in knowing that they are you or like you, but actually in the working to understand is where you meet with them. And I think that that's, you know, where we find connection, even though we're separate.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's the difference between, like, you know, are we actually being like Jesus? Are we actually like understanding Jesus and helping the refugee, you know, and helping the poor? Or are we, you right. know, like, are we meeting Jesus where he is?
Right. Yeah. It was that thing that like Zizek said a long time ago, which I mean, like everybody got upset with him about, where she was like, and maybe I'm being too generous with him. I mean, he said a lot of things that I disagree with. So maybe I'm being too generous, but he was like, you know, is it true that like people, you know, certain immigrants can move to the US and like somehow people will get along and that their culture matches ours? No. He was like, no. But what he was saying in that moment was, and you let them in anyway, because it's not about you resolving the contradiction between you and them. It's about striving to be with, you know, alongside. And I think that that's a good way of talking about love, you know, striving to be alongside. And I think that that's also a good way of talking about death, striving to be alongside, but without the person. Well,
yeah. I mean, that's the discussion that's had so often about Scandinavian countries and how they're able to have these really robust public health programs and support systems and childcare systems, because there's not, and that may be because there's not a lot of diversity. To them. And so like, is the spiritual, okay, you can look at the Scandinavian country and hold them up as a model and be like, look, the spiritual practice here is supporting everyone around you and loving your neighbor. But then when you throw the spanner in the wheel of like, yeah, but what if your neighbor doesn't look like you and have the same religion as you,
right,
and have the same outlook on the world? Isn't that actually the spiritual practice, the higher spiritual practice to understand and live with all? You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, the answer is not don't do that, but it seems to me that a lot of our examples of that sort of beautiful socialism are really pristine. I mean, even like socialist communities of like crust punks all share a lot of the same values.
Totally. And I think it's something that you and your work and something that you and I talk about all the time is really, again, it's like I am enduring through you, through the transformation of this person into loss, into absence, I'm enduring a profound shock to my own identity and who I used to be. And I think the other version of that is, you know, I'm enduring a profound shock of my identity because you're here, you know? And so I like this little lemniscate of love and death that we've created. And we'll turn that little lemniscate, tip it up and turn it into a heart.
Oh, cute. It's a Venn diagram. It's also a candy heart.
The candy heart of infinity.
Yeah, the candy heart of infinity. That is my respect for you, even though I agree with nothing you say.
You know, actually, if you bend the lemniscate up to make a heart, it actually makes a pretzel. And we both like pretzels.
You're right. I cannot tell a lie. Throw some beer cheese world. On that.
And pretzels are from Denmark. And we were just talking about Scandinavian countries. So it all comes together, I think, quite nicely. Problem solved. Reality defined. Thank you, Caitlin Doty.
Oh, I'm always happy to define truth with you on this podcast.
You heard it here first, people. All right. Thanks a lot. And thanks everybody for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.